Tonight, we're continuing in the 13th chapter of the book of Hebrews, which begins in verse 1. Let love of the brethren continue. Forget not to show love unto strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. Remember them that are in bonds, as bound with them that are ill-treated, as being yourselves also in the body. The Hebrew writer in this 13th chapter is informing these brethren of what I like to call sundry admonitions. There's really not a continuing thought that runs throughout the chapter. There are a number of thoughts that are introduced one after another. When he says, let love of the brethren continue, the writer is indicating that they do have and have displayed an attitude of love toward each other, and he is encouraging them that that should continue. When he tells them to forget not to show love unto strangers and to remember them that are in bonds, he's not telling them anything that they don't know or that they've not been practicing. In the 10th chapter, of course, we've looked at verse 32, where the writer calls upon them to remember the things that they've done in the past. And in that list of things, he says, beginning at verse 33, he says, partly being made a gazing stock both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly becoming partakers with them that were so used. For ye both had compassion on them that were in bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your possessions, knowing that ye have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. They have already shared in the affliction that their brethren have endured. And so the writer in the 13th chapter is urging them to continue in the things that they're already practicing. Now, when we come to verse 4, we deliberately slowed down and basically have come to a snail's crawl on verse 4 because of the subject matter that is introduced here that over the past few years has become quite controversial and even divisive among brethren. Certainly, there are a lot of what-if circumstantial questions that might be asked. And unless we have the foundation principles down pat, then answering the what-if questions only becomes confusing. And so before we get into a lot of what-if this and what-if that, I want to discuss the things that are contained in some detail in Hebrews the 13th chapter and in verse 4. In verse 4, the writer says, let marriage be had in honor among all, and let the bed be undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. In the context of this verse, we see clearly that the writer is pronouncing the condemnation of God upon certain individuals. Those who practice fornication, those who are adulterers, receive the judgment or the condemnation of God. It would behoove us then to know who fornicators are, what that is. It would also behoove us to understand what an adulterer is, lest we fall into the category of the condemnation of God. Interestingly enough, when we talk about the term fornication or fornicator, it comes to us from the Greek expression porneia. And you can almost hear the word pornography in the word porneia. But the word porneia is an illicit sexual intercourse. It's used a number of times throughout the Scriptures. It also includes adultery on a number of occasions. On other occasions, it's distinguished from it. The word adultery or adulterer comes to us from a different word, and it denotes one who has unlawful intercourse with the spouse of another. That's how the term is used in our text of Hebrews chapter 13 and in verse 4. I've drawn or tried to draw a couple of circles to illustrate the difference between adultery and fornication. If you'll notice, the larger circle is identified with the word fornication. It's more inclusive. It includes adultery. We might want to note that all adultery, therefore, is fornication, but not all fornication is adultery. Adultery being distinct in that it involves those who are married. Fornication may involve those who are married or those who are not married, and therein lies the distinction. But when we use the word adultery, in Matthew the 19th chapter, you can't discuss these subjects, obviously, without talking about Matthew, the 19th chapter. And we're going to spend a good bit of our time tonight talking about some of the text from Matthew 19:9, as well as some other texts that we want to look at in our study tonight. But in Matthew 19 and in verse 9 specifically, it says, "And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And he that marrieth her when she is put away, committeth adultery." Let us understand that Jesus begins verse 9 with the expression, "whosoever." I say unto you, whosoever. All cases of divorce and remarriage result in adultery, with one exception. Divorce your mate and marry another, you're guilty of adultery. You marry one who is divorced without cause, that is, without the cause of fornication, you're guilty of adultery. The put-away fornicator who marries a new partner is guilty of adultery. You'll notice that one little word up there. The exception is whosoever divorces their mate for fornication and marries another is not guilty of adultery. Now we want to talk tonight a little bit about that expression, except. But before we do, it's important that we identify what God's law is governing marriage. God's rule is very simple. And young people, we have a number in the audience tonight. You nail this down real good. God's law is one man, one woman, for life, one exception. One man, one woman, for life, one exception. Only one exception to this rule. Now what we want to notice is the design of the marriage relationship from the beginning. We're going to see and study in our study tonight from Matthew chapter 19 that Jesus makes a number of appeals to what God's law was in the beginning. In fact, twice He makes reference to God's law in the beginning. In Genesis chapter 2, let's read together beginning in verse 18. The writer says, "And Jehovah God said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a help meet." The word meet simply means answering to, corresponding to, or suitable to. "I will make him a help meet for him. And out of the ground Jehovah God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens and brought them unto the man to see what he would call them. And whatsoever the man called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And the man gave names to all cattle and to the birds of the heavens and to every beast of the field. But for man there was not found a help meet for him. And Jehovah God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which Jehovah God had taken from the man made he a woman and brought her unto the man. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." God's ideal for the marriage relationship is established in the beginning. When the Apostle Paul sought to illustrate the kind of unity, the kind of fellowship, the kind of love that should exist between Christ and His church, the Apostle Paul centered his attention on the marriage relationship as God intended for it to be. In the Ephesian letter, in chapter 5, reading beginning in verse 30, he says, "Because we are members of the body, for this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I speak in regard of Christ and the church." As the Apostle Paul describes that relationship of Christ and the church, he uses the relationship of marriage and refers to God's plan in the beginning to describe the unity that is to exist between Christ and the church. Now in Matthew the 19th chapter, once again, we want to notice beginning in verse 3. It says, "And there came unto him Pharisees trying him." The question that the Pharisees ask is to test Jesus to see which school of thought that Jesus would appeal to. And their question is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? The context of Matthew 19 is established with this question. It's essential for us to see that these Pharisees are not asking Jesus a question about remarriage. Do you see that? They're asking a question about divorce. Their question is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife, that is, to put her away for just any cause? Now, we could be elaborate in listing all kinds of causes, but let's just say in brief, can a man divorce his wife from anything from bad breath to burned biscuits? Anything in that category, anything in between, can a man divorce his wife for just any cause? Now that's the question that they're asking. He answered them and said, "Have ye not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female?" Look carefully at that. He who made them from the beginning, male and female, and said, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Notice again that Jesus is asking them, in response to their question about divorce, "Have you not read what God said from the beginning?" When Jesus answers their question, He comments on that and says, "So that there are no more two, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." Now Jesus is very specific in answering their question about divorce. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? If you were taking a multiple choice test, and the answer to that question is either yes or no, how would you answer it? You're taking too long to answer. It's a simple question. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? Yes or no?
No.
The answer is no. Jesus responded to their question with a very adamant, "No, it is not lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause." Now they say unto him, "Why then did Moses command to give a bill of divorcement and to put her away?" We're going to talk briefly tonight about Deuteronomy 24, the first few verses of that chapter that is alluded to by these Pharisees in Matthew 19. But it's important for us to note the response of Jesus to their comment relative to Deuteronomy 24. Jesus said unto them, "Moses, for your hardness of heart," let's underscore that, "Moses did not command them to do anything, but Moses, for your hardness of heart, suffered you to do something. Moses did not command them to put away their wives, but yet what we do see is that Moses suffered them to do so." But notice Jesus' comment on that. He said, "But from the beginning it hath not been so." Now again, the question that's asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any cause? Has the answer changed, or is the answer still no? It's still no. And Jesus appeals to what God said from the beginning regulating the relationship of marriage. Now look at verse 9. Jesus said, "And I say unto you," what does that do to whatever Moses said? All right, it supersedes the authority of Moses. Whatever Moses said has now been ended by this statement of Jesus in verse 9. "And I say unto you," Jesus is appealing to His own authority. As the Christ, as the Son of God, "I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And he that marrieth her when she is put away, committeth adultery." Now we need to talk about that some. Let's notice Genesis chapter 2 verse 24 as Jesus explains it in Matthew chapter 19 in verses 3 through verse 9. Notice again the question. Is it lawful for a man to divorce or to put away his wife for every cause? Jesus answered them, and notice verse 5. "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife." Genesis chapter 2 verse 24 regulating the marriage relationship from the beginning requires a man and a woman. Do we see that? God made them Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. That's just as simple as it can be. It requires a man and a woman. From the beginning, God required that. It excludes all immorality. A man is joined to his wife. They become one flesh, Jesus said. The one flesh relationship would exclude fornication. It would exclude adultery, polygamy, concubines, homosexuality, bestiality. All of those things are excluded because Jesus said they shall become a man, his wife, one flesh. Also in this statement by Jesus in Matthew 19, it implies that immorality desecrates the union. Immorality, or fornication rather, to be specific, becomes the grounds for the innocent one to put away the guilty one. Notice, if you would please, again. Jesus said that in the beginning it was stated that a man shall leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This leaving and cleaving was intended to be a relationship that would last throughout life. Therefore, fornication desecrates the union of the one flesh relationship. Also in Jesus' comments, he explains how that the put away fornicator is excluded from marrying another. I think Terry talked with you earlier in the studies how that a sinner cannot profit from his sin. Some look, and I have some tracts in my library, where a man is defending the position that if one is free, then both parties are free. Therefore, if one may put away their companion for the cause of fornication, then the guilty companion, the guilty fornicator, therefore being put away, does not have a companion. Therefore, they're free to be joined to another. Do you not see how that puts a premium on sin? You see, if I don't like Donna and I want to be married to somebody else, then all I need to do to be free from Donna is just commit fornication so she'll divorce me, and then I can marry whoever I want to. But you see, if we just don't get along and she burns the beans and she divorces me or I divorce her, then you see, that hangs both of us out to dry. You see, the one free, both free theory would put a premium on sin. But Jesus said that the put away fornicator is excluded from the privilege of joining themselves to a new companion. And Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 13 tells us that God's commandments are for our good. God's commandments are not regulating us so that we can profit by our own sin. But sin brings hardship, not privileges. In Proverbs chapter 13, verse 15, the writer said, "The way of the transgressor is hard." What we learn in these two passages is that God did not design a plan whereby man can benefit or profit from his own sin. Another thing that we want to see in Jesus' comments on Genesis 2 and in verse 24, specifically in verse 6 of Matthew 19, he says, "So that they are no more two, but one flesh." The marriage relationship, it is implied in this text, is a bond that lasts in this life. That is, it is a one flesh relationship. You remember in Matthew the 22nd chapter, when the Sadducees asked Jesus a question that they thought would be a perplexing question about a man who had seven brothers, and that the law said that if a man die and he has no children, then his brother is to take his wife and raise children to his brother's honor. And so the first brother died, and the second brother took his wife, no children. The second brother died, the third brother took his wife, no children. And so forth until all seven had been married to this one woman. And so the question then that they pose is, in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? You remember Jesus' statement, in the resurrection, they are neither married or given in marriage. What do we learn about marriage from that statement and the statement of Jesus commenting on Genesis 2? we learn that the marriage relationship is a relationship that exists in the flesh. It is in this life that we are married. We're not married in the resurrection, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 22. So the marriage bond is a bond that relates only to this life. It is a life and relationship in the fleshly body. Now perhaps that's a given, but we need to talk about it because Jesus talks about it in Matthew chapter 19. But we also want to underscore this expression that occurs twice in Matthew 19. From the beginning, it hath not been so. We've seen God's ideal in Genesis chapter 2 and in verse 24. But that ideal is reflected throughout Old Testament history. We want to look at these passages and then make some applications of them in our next chart. But if you'll notice in Exodus chapter 20, when Moses gives the law, or God through Moses gives the Ten Commandment law unto the children of Israel, you'll notice in verse 14 the commandment, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." Now, based upon what we've read in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, wouldn't you think that to be a given? "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. What therefore," Jesus said, "God has joined together, let not man put asunder." This relationship is intended from the beginning to be a lifelong relationship. To vary from that relationship was contrary to God's law from the beginning. To the nation of Israel, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." If you'll turn over to Leviticus chapter 10, or chapter 20, verse 10, the text tells us, "And the man that committeth adultery with another man's wife, even he that committeth adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death." Now that doesn't need a lot of explaining, does it? Under that Old Testament system, God's ideal was you leave father and mother and you cleave unto your wife. You stick, as Bruce pointed out to us in a previous study, like two pieces of metal that are welded together, so that the two pieces of metal flow into each other to form a bond. Leave and cleave. Those who disregarded God's law under that Old Testament system, the law of Moses, they were to be put to death. Leviticus chapter 20 and in verse 10. Turn over now, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22. In this text, it says in verse 22, "If a man be found lying with a woman married to a husband, then they shall both of them die, the man that lay with the woman and the woman. So shalt thou put away the evil from Israel." Now again, that doesn't need a lot of explaining. God's attitude toward a man that lays with another man's wife, and we're going to talk about that, time permitting, to show that it's possible for one man to be married to another man's wife. It's possible for a woman to be married to this man while being this man's wife. Now what we see in this illustration is of Deuteronomy 22 and verse 22, according to the law, is that both of them should be put to death who committed the sin of adultery. Interestingly enough, when we come to the last book of the Old Testament, to the book of Malachi, you'll notice in chapter 2, reading beginning in verse 14, Malachi chapter 2, verse 14. "Yet ye say, wherefore? Because Jehovah hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth." Young people, let me ask you, and any one of you feel free to answer. When Malachi says, "Because Jehovah hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth," what wife is that? The wife of thy youth. Who would that be? Randy? The first one. You're not among the young people. In fact, you're about my age. You're younger than I. You're not among the young people. That's what I hear. But as we identify in this text, the writer says, "Between the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, though she is thy companion and the wife of thy covenant, And did he not make one, although he had the residue of the Spirit? And wherefore one? He sought a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth, for I hate putting away. Any of you reading from a translation that says, I hate divorce? All right, it's very clear, isn't it? What's God's attitude toward putting away? God hates it. We see that clearly defined in that we see that they were not to commit adultery under the law of Moses. The man and the woman who were guilty of the act of adultery were to be put to death. God's attitude toward putting away is seen in this text. God hates it. And so we need to note that from the beginning, this putting away process was not God's ideal. God despises it. He hates it. Now, as we look again at God's ideal, I want you to follow at the top of this chart for just a moment, because it is essentially a timeline. And what we see on this timeline is God's ideal from the beginning. Coming down about 20 generations, we find God giving instruction to Abraham to leave the land that he is in, that is Ur of Chaldee, and go into a land that I will show thee. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3, we read of the land promise, the nation promise, and the seed promise, the promises that were given to Abraham, beginning the development of the nation of Israel and the scheme of redemption to come through Christ that would come through that nation. We see then the giving of the law of Moses. We see that referred to in Galatians chapter 3 on the timeline. And we see contained in the law of Moses what God's attitude is toward adultery. We follow this to the gospel of Christ, where Jesus said that from the beginning it hath not been so. What Jesus says over here references God's ideal over here. Does everybody see that? That's not hard, is it? Here's God's ideal over here in Genesis chapter 2. Jesus commented on that in Matthew chapter 19. But yet we see, even though that was God's plan from the beginning, Matthew chapter 19, verse 8, man had deviated from that not long after the beginning. If you'll turn back to Genesis chapter 4, Genesis chapter 4, in verse 18, verse 19, and Lamech took unto him two wives. The name of the one was Ada, and the name of the other, Zillah. What is it that Lamech has done that's contrary to God's plan from the beginning? He's now got two wives. God said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. Lamech's already messed up, and we're just a couple or three chapters beyond the beginning. Yes, David?
And you can see what kind of arrogant guy he is. You keep reading on down. He is very arrogant and stuff. And so he's very rebellious against God. It wasn't like accidentally. You know,
that's right.
He was on purpose.
That's right. That's right. So what we're looking at is something that is evidently a deliberate deviation from God's law. But that's not always true. What we see even regarding Abraham, who is called at least three times in Scripture, the friend of God. We find in Genesis chapter 12, we'll not read the entirety of it, verses 10 through verse 20, Abraham messed up. What did he do? How did he want to identify his wife when he was among the Egyptians? And why did he do that? As his sister. All right, he was afraid that he was going to be killed. So what does he do with his wife? He offers his wife legitimately to become somebody else's wife. But that was contrary to God's plan from the beginning. And we notice in Genesis chapter 16, what else did Abraham do in the first three verses? It says, now Sarai, Abraham's wife, bare him no children. And she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, Jehovah hath restrained me from bearing. Go in, I pray thee, unto my handmaid. It may be that I shall obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her handmaid, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to Abraham, her husband, to be his wife. Now what's taking place? We see that Abram, later called Abraham, is messing up again. What's he doing now? All right, this is not according to God's ideal, is it? We find that Hagar, Sarai's handmaid, is now given unto Abraham to play the part of a wife unto Abraham through which he might bear children. Now turn to the page again, if you will, over to Genesis chapter 25. In Genesis chapter 25, we'll drop down in the text to verse 6. It says, "But unto the sons of the concubines that Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts, and he sent them away from Isaac his son, while he yet lived eastward unto the east country." Abraham had what? Concubines. What was God's plan from the beginning? "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." We see deviation from God's ideal almost from the beginning. In Genesis chapter 26, verses 1 through 11, we see Isaac doing essentially the same thing that Abraham did, as he offers his wife to become the wife of others, lest he himself be subject to ridicule or perhaps even death. And you see the same thing in Genesis chapter 30, where a maid, a handmaid, is taken through which children were to be born. Now we see, against the backdrop of God's plan from the beginning, that Jesus refers to in Matthew chapter 19, that there is deviation from God's original plan almost from the very beginning. Would it then not surprise you that there is deviation from God's plan during the time that these Pharisees are asking this question, and deviation from God's original plan during the very time in which you live? Man has always had, it would seem, little regard for what God said about marriage. Little regard for what God said even from the beginning. That's why Jesus answers the question, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for any cause?" Jesus goes back to the beginning and says, here's what God's ideal was from the beginning that man has had little regard for throughout the generation. So Jesus answers their question about divorce. He says, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause?" "No," Jesus said, "not for any cause, but for one cause." Now they raise the question, "What about what Moses said?" Now these "what about" or "what if" questions are not new. These Jews want to ask, "What if" or "what about" what Moses said in Deuteronomy chapter 24. Now I want to turn with you to Deuteronomy chapter 24 and notice that in this text, Moses is not commanding that they give a bill of divorcement to put their wives away. But what Moses is doing is regulating a practice that has become rampant among the Jews in particular, but it also has become a deviation from God's law from the beginning. Do you see that? Man has never had much regard for what God said about the marriage relationship. So what Moses says to the nation of Israel, following the command in the law, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," is to regulate their practice and turn them back to God's original plan from the beginning. In Deuteronomy 24, in verse 1, it says, "When a man taketh a wife, and marrieth her, then shall it be, if she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some unseemly thing in her, that he shall write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of his house." Now what I want you to see is a manner of writing in this text that is very similar in some respects, as we have pointed out in studies gone by, to Paul's writings in the epistles. For example, in Paul's writings, you're familiar with the statement, "Not this, but this," or "put off and put on." It becomes a contrasting statement. In this text of Deuteronomy 24, we see a similar statement. When this happens, then here's how you handle it. Do you see that? When a man taketh a wife and marrieth her, then it shall be, if she find no favor in his eyes because he hath found some unseemly thing in her, that he shall write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. Now look carefully at that. When she's departed out of her first husband's house, she may become another man's wife. Now, I believe Richard, in the study with you that he presented in the sermon talking about marriage and divorce, talked about this very passage and indicated that this unseemly thing was not adultery. Now, you've already read tonight what we know was the consequence of adultery. What was it? Death. In this text, the woman who is put away may become another man's wife. The woman who committed adultery, according to Deuteronomy 22:22, was to be killed. She would not be the wife of any man. Do you see that? Whatever this unseemly thing is, and I don't know with preciseness what it was. You don't either. The Bible simply doesn't tell us. It indicates some immorality about the woman, some unseemly thing. But it also tells us whatever it was, it was not adultery. It was something short of adultery because she might become the wife of another man. What we see further in this text is in verse 3, and if the latter husband hate her and write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, who took her to be his wife, her former husband, who sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife after that she is defiled, for that is an abomination before Jehovah, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin which Jehovah thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. Now we're going to come back to this passage in just a moment, but I want you to see that in Deuteronomy 24, Moses suffered them to do something, Jesus said, regulating a practice that was already existent and had run rampant among the Jews. Yes, Randy?
The New American Standard reads a little bit different.
All right.
in such a way that, again, I don't know if the verb tense is in Hebrew, what they were originally or not supposed to read. The way it reads in the New American Standard, everything is incidental until it gets to verse 4.
All right. All right.
He says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he's found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, and puts it in her hand, and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce, and puts it in her hand, and sends her out of the house, or if the latter husband dies and turns her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not to be allowed, is not allowed to take her wife, since she has been defiled, but that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. The point being, it sounds like the only regulation that's actually being stated in those four verses is that a woman who's divorced can't remarry the same husband.
That's one of them. What I would like to suggest likewise in this context, he regulates the cause of putting away some unseemly thing, whatever that is. Now keep in mind, the Jews have asked the question of the Lord, can a man divorce his wife for just any cause? And then they cite what Moses said. Moses did not grant divorce for just any cause. That's how the Jews in Matthew 19 are using Deuteronomy 24. Moses didn't do that. Moses regulated the practice by saying for some unseemly thing, and then here's the consequence. You cannot be joined to your first husband again. Now let me suggest on that if you knew that if you put her away, it can't be for just any cause and please the Lord. If you knew that if you put her away, it's for this cause and only for this cause, but if you do that, You can't ever have her back. Do you think that if you're interested in either anything resembling right or wrong, you would think twice before you put her away? You wouldn't do so frivolously, as was the practice of the Jews. Moses is regulating a practice that was rampant, even from the beginning, as we see in Genesis chapter 4. He's trying to turn them back to the seriousness of the marriage relationship, a man, his wife, for life. Okay, Carolyn?
In your version, it has the word may. She may go and become another man's wife.
Uh-huh.
Is it saying that she's authorized to do so, or is it just saying, and in the case that she should happen to do that, then it continues with the scenario?
She's authorized to do that, according to this text. That's why we want to point out that the cause in Matthew chapter 19 and the cause in Deuteronomy 24 are not the same. Moses granted this for some unseemly thing. She may become another man's wife. Jesus said, except for this cause, the cause of fornication. And we're going to talk about that. So the cause has changed. It's not the same cause that Moses was talking about in Deuteronomy 24. And that's very significant to the context of Matthew 19. Young people, are you getting all of this? It's important that you get this before you get yourself into a mess and lose your soul. David?
On your example of adultery, they both stoned. But they had to have a witness of 2 or 3 before they could be stoned.
That's correct.
Okay. In this case of the divorce, did they have to have a witness of 2 or 3 or not? I didn't see that anywhere.
Not to some unseemly thing, because we don't know what the unseemly thing was. I don't know.
But I just wonder, because the commentary I was reading, it said that this divorce that Moses allowed was adultery.
I've read that. I don't believe that.
Yeah, well, I don't either. But his argument is that because there was a lot of adulterers in the Jewish time that did not get stoned because they wouldn't have a witness of 2 or 3. And so he said this was
I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that.
I never thought about all of this. They had to have a witness of 2 or 3 for the divorce, not the one for the stoning.
That question I don't know the answer to. But I don't agree that the unseemly thing was adultery. Yeah.
That was his reasoning.
Yeah.
He points out in Matthew 19 that the Jews, of course, it's like you said, I read another commentary said that they could divorce. The Jews had it where you could get divorced.
That's right.
Wife burnt the breakfast is his example and stuff. So he said Jesus was clarifying that unseemly thing was adultery in Matthew 19. Again, I still don't agree with that, but the Jews that unseemly thing had gone coldly to any excuse at all.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't meant for that even from the law.
No. And what we see then in Deuteronomy 24 and Malachi chapter 2 is that the Jews were regulated in their practice of putting away for just any cause. God hates it. He despises it. He regulated it in Deuteronomy 24. Now what about the Gentiles, those who were not under the law of Moses? In Romans chapter 1, we've been studying about the Gentiles, verses 18 through verse 32, and we've noted that their practice had become rampant. To say adultery was the practice would be a mild statement. They were guilty of fornication in every respect. God gave them up to practice vile things, the text tells us in Romans chapter 1. In verses 18 through verse 32. So Gentiles were condemned because of their practice. Jews were condemned because of their practice. Deviation from God's original law had been rampant among both Jews and Gentiles almost from the beginning. Now I want to qualify that. I said among Jews and Gentiles, among mankind, almost from the beginning. Of course, I'm aware Jews didn't come until the descent of Abraham. I want you to understand that. But going back to Matthew 19, and in verse 9, "And I say unto you," we noted that a moment ago, Jesus appeals to his own authority. And then he says, whosoever shall put away his wife, that is, divorce his wife. Now we want to emphasize that expression, except for fornication. That little expression bears a great deal of weight. This expression, except for fornication. The expression, except, is used in a lot of passages in the New Testament. It carries the weight or the force of if and only if this condition is present. For example, in Matthew chapter 18 and in verse 3, Jesus said, "Verily I say unto you, except you become as this little child, ye shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven." Jesus uses the term except. Jesus says this condition must be present. This condition, if it is not present, you cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Isn't that simple? We don't have any problem understanding the word except in Matthew chapter 18, do we? When Nicodemus spoke to Jesus, he said, "For I perceive that thou art a prophet, for no man can do the things that thou doest except God be with him." What is it that Nicodemus recognizes about Jesus? The condition of God being with him must be present, or you couldn't do the things that you're doing. Do we see that? That's real simple, isn't it? In John chapter 3 and verse 5, Jesus said to Nicodemus, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born anew, he cannot enter the kingdom of God." Jesus said it to him again, "Verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born of the water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God." Now, do we have any problem understanding what except means in John chapter 3? It means that if this condition is present, this condition must exist in order to enter into the kingdom of God. Now, when Jesus used the expression in Matthew chapter 19 and in verse 9, except for fornication, Jesus said this condition must be present. Now what if it's not? What if it's not present? Then the result is adultery. Do you see that? If that condition is not present, then the result is adultery. Now that's just the way it is. That condition must be present. How did Jesus say that? He used that little word, except. Now we don't have a problem where else that passage or that word is used, but somehow when we come to Matthew 19:9, we get it in our minds that that condition somehow doesn't have to be present. Jesus said it did. In every case where a divorce occurs and a remarriage occurs, that exception must be present. If it's not, adultery is the result. Now isn't that simple? That's not hard. Matthew 19 is not hard, but sometimes we make it hard because of all the conjecture and because of all the emotion that is packed into that particular verse. We'll have to talk about this some more because I'm not through.